of Registrant JDF. May we please have appearances of counsel?
James Maynard, representing JDF, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Jonathan Ingram on behalf of Amicus, the Office of the Public Defender.
Good morning, Chief Justice Jeffrey L. Weinstein, Acting Assistant Prosecutor and Special Deputy Attorney General on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Emily R. Anderson, Deputy Attorney General on behalf of the Attorney General as Amicus.
Welcome, counsel, and good morning. Mr. Maynard.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
That's fine. Please go ahead.
Thank you. In Landgraf versus USI Film Products, Justice Stevens wrote, quote, elementary considerations of fairness dictate that individuals should have the opportunity to know what the law is and to conform their conduct accordingly. Grounded in this principle, the GHGA court held that subsection G of Megan's law cannot be applied retroactively. That's at page 113. Therefore, subsection G can only be applied prospectively. But what does it mean to say a law must be applied prospectively? To answer that question, we must ask to whom does it apply? When does it apply? To what does it apply? And why must it be applied that way? Statutes normally tell you who the law applies to and the effective date of the law. But that information is not enough to know what the law applies to. Statutes do not tell how to apply the effective date to an actual case. Fortunately, we have two centuries of case law that definitively answer that question. Conduct is the trigger for prospectivity. Why has two centuries of jurisprudence held that conduct is the favored, rational, and fair trigger for prospectivity, rather than some other event such as a plea, conviction, or civil judgment? New Jersey courts have recognized that the preference for prospective application of new legislation is based on our long-held notions of fairness and due process. That's in James versus New Jersey Manufacturing. Applying new laws to conduct is the only way to guarantee the critical due process protection of prior notice. Justice Scalia summed it up in Kaiser v. Bongiorno. The principle that the legal effect of conduct should ordinarily be assessed under the law that existed when the conduct took place has timeless and universal appeal. Fairness and due process requires giving individuals the opportunity to know the law and to conform their conduct to the law before they are subject to the law. No amount of notice after conduct has occurred can restore a defendant's due process rights. For example, by the time JDF's conviction, it was too late to alter the conduct that triggered subsection G. Regarding the use of the term conviction in the GH opinion, the appellate division only mentions conviction because of the posture of the case before it. Both registrants were convicted before the effective date of subsection G. The term conviction in GHGA is dicta because it was not specifically briefed or argued or considered by the court as a trigger to prospectivity. Any use of the word conviction in GHGA was only a reference to the fact pattern of the case and the language of the briefing, not a holding on what triggers prospectivity. In conclusion, the state argues that subsection G uses the term conviction to trigger its application. This misreads not just subsection G, but the entire criminal code. Defendants aren't sentenced to a term of imprisonment because of a conviction. Defendants are sentenced to prison based on the criminal conduct they engaged in. A conviction is nothing more than a finding by a fact finder or court that certain conduct has occurred. Subsection G uses the word conviction to establish that the underlying conduct covered by subsection G has in fact occurred. The state's view of GH disposes of the right of notice prior to conduct. That is at the core of due process. For the reasons stated in JDF's briefing and argument, this court should hold that subsection G applies only to conduct that occurred after a law's effective date. Remand this case to the trial court for consideration of JDF's Megan's Law termination petition on the merits. I would like to say in addition that the doctrine of prospectivity is that the only event in a person's life that should subject them to criminal punishment or civil liability is the conduct that violates a provision of law in existence at the time the conduct has occurred. All of the cases, virtually all of the cases cited in GH and relied on by the court, Riley, Hester, James, Cruz, Gibbons, all posit notice before conduct as a fundamental premise for due process and fundamental fairness. And finally, Megan's Law is a prospective law with narrow retroactive components. Subsection A and G use very similar language to define who is subject to the law. Both use the phrase a person who's been convicted, adjudicated delinquent, or found not guilty by reason of insanity for commission of a sex offense. The legislature gave Megan's Law limited retroactivity in subsection B. Subsection B1 applied Megan's Law to registrants who committed certain offenses and were found repetitive and compulsive, regardless of the date of commission of the offense or date of conviction. That's clear retroactive language. Subsection B2 made Megan's Law retroactive to anyone who was still on some form of supervision, irrespective of the date of the offense or conviction. Also, explicit retroactive language. Megan's Law shows that the legislature knows how to write retroactive laws, and they didn't do that with subsection G. Subsection G was adopted to get federal funding. The state mischaracterized the legislature's purpose in enacting subsection G. It was not adopted to increase the protection of New Jersey citizens. LE and CK have found that subsection G was adopted solely to secure federal funding under the Jacob Wetterling Act. The Jacob Wetterling Act did not require retroactivity. It was a prospective funding source. CK also found that when the Wetterling Act was repealed in 2006, the funding purpose of subsection G was removed. So actually, the original purpose of subsection G no longer exists.
Mr. Maynard, following up on the point you were just making, how does your argument square with Doe v. Poritz, which upheld the retroactive application of Megan's Law? Is there any tension between the two?
None whatsoever. Doe v. Poritz and all of the foundational law for Megan's Law upheld that, it stated and upheld that Megan's Law was a prospective remedial purpose program with limited retroactive applications only applied by subsection B1 and 2, which identifies the express and explicit individuals to be applied to. Subsection B1, certain offenses, repetitive and compulsive. Subsection B2, individuals who were under some sort of supervision for a sex offense at the time of the enactment of Megan's Law. Other than that, there is no retroactive application of Megan's Law. It is a prospective scheme.
So Mr. Maynard, I take it that your argument begins with the premise that GH has already settled that subsection G may not be applied retroactively.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Is the line.
So the only question is, as you framed it at the outset of your argument, whether or not the way in which the state is seeking to have this court interpret it, it is in fact a retroactive application.
That is how the state seems to be interpreting it. I would state that it has unequivocally been determined not to be applicable retroactively in any way to any circumstance the beginning of application of subsection G is January 8th, 2002, and it can apply to nothing, not conviction, not conduct, not sentencing, to anything prior to that date. Now, what the state, what we are assessing here is prospectivity, the trigger to prospective application.
And as I understand your argument, it's relying upon traditional case law that looks to examine what is the legal status of a person's conduct at the time it's occurring. That is the typical focus.
Absolutely. And right. And since we know A, that subsection G can't be applied in any way retroactively, we're looking at what is the trigger for prospective application. Is it conduct, conviction, sentencing, someone's birthday, something else?
So is your argument predominantly based upon statutory interpretation and legislative intent? Do we need to reach manifest injustice?
Not at all. You never reach manifest injustice or vested right if you don't have explicit or implicit retroactivity, which we don't have here. So we do not have retroactivity in subsection G, so we can ignore vested right and manifested justice. Those are secondary prongs after the primary prong of retroactivity has been established. So all that goes out into the garbage, all right? The only thing we are focused on is the trigger to prospective application of subsection G. What event in a person's life must have occurred on or after January 8th, 2002 that could subject them to the lifetime bar determination of subsection G? Now, we're really confined. We're not talking about when the person graduated from high school or when they got married. We're talking about what aspect as it relates to our laws that would subject someone to Megan's Law occurred on or after January 8th, 2002, that would bring them into being the compliance with the terms of subsection G. And so is it conduct? Is it conviction? Is it sentencing? Is it the date they were put on Megan's Law? These are the rational, this is the rational scope of the inquiry here. What triggers prospectivity? And we're saying that it's more than 200 years. It's almost since the dawn of the understanding of humanity of fair play and fairness. That's how long the concept of notice before penalty has existed. And knowing what's wrong so that you can conform your conduct to right and wrong since the Garden of Eden. So we know what's wrong and we can conform our conduct or not conform our conduct. And if we do not conform our conduct, we get the penalty of original sin. And if we do conform our conduct, we stay in the Garden of Eden. So that's how long the concept of knowing right and wrong before you act and are subjected to penalty for acting in the wrong way exists.
So, Mr. Maynard, this is a case of statutory interpretation. It's just, you're superimposing canons of statutory interpretation.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that it is not so much a case of statutory interpretation as it is of constitutionality. We know that you must have fundamental fairness.
Wait. The first thing, tell me if I'm mistaken. The first thing we always do in any analysis is try to figure out what did the legislature intend? Did they intend this to be prospective or to be retroactive? Did they give language in the statute indicating it? And if that's the first thing that we do. If the statute is clear, we just apply it. Obviously, it's not clear. That's the reason why you're talking about these canons of interpretation that you say go back before the memory of man and woman.
Yes, we've established that it's not to be applied retroactively. So we've established that. So all we're doing is understanding the trigger to prospectivity. So as a matter, it may involve both statutory interpretation, but it also involves fundamental fairness and due process.
I understand. So this is, I'm not certain why you threw out the concept of manifest injustice. So it's manifest. This is my understanding of the doctrine of manifest injustice. It is a doctrine, and it's a doctrine of statutory interpretation. We look at a statute, and when it's susceptible to two interpretations, we accept the interpretation that would not cause a manifest injustice. I think some of our case law has confused this, but if you look back at the very roots of that doctrine, it is sort of a canon of statutory interpretation. I'm trying to figure out, like, why aren't you using that as one of your weapons in your quiver?
Your Honor, I will only use the term manifest injustice to answer Justice LaVecchia's question to say that we do not reach manifest injustice or vested right because this law is not retroactive. It has been found and determined not to be retroactively applicable in any way. So the only thing we're dealing with is what is the trigger to prospective application. And in JDF's case, JDF's original offense conduct predated the enactment of subsection G. His conviction postdated it. So because it straddles the effective date of subsection G, that's the issue here. And so we have to determine whether conduct or some other event is the appropriate trigger for prospective application of law.
I get that. It seems to me that one of the arguments in your favor, if it's not conduct and it's something else, then it's going to be subject to a number of variables, the charging process, when the crime is reported, whether there's this prosecutorial delay, whether or not there's judicial postponements, and all sorts of other variables would come into play if there isn't a bright line such as conduct. Is that one of your arguments?
Right. Absolutely right. It not only would it violate fundamental fairness and due process of prior notice, prior notice requirement of due process, but also if you use some other event, a sentencing, a plea, a conviction, there are so many things that go into it. First of all, not everyone's offered a plea. The prosecutor, there's one case where the prosecutor went on vacation, and by the time they got back from vacation, the law had changed. It's an absolutely unworkable system from a practical standpoint to use anything other than conduct. The conduct is the only defining event that relates to the application of a criminal law or civil law. So conduct is the one thing that happens that has a true one-to-one linear relationship to the application of a criminal law and criminal punishment or civil law and civil liability. Conduct. Anything else is subject to variables outside of the control of the defendant or outside of the control of that individual. So that what the prosecutor had for lunch may put him in a bad mood and not want to offer him a deal that he's willing to take. The variables are infinite as to what can affect the application of the law to an individual if it is not conduct. And all the statutes are all written related to conduct, the elements of an offense, the mens rea, the actus reus. It's all about conduct. Our system of law is based in its entirety on the concept of conduct yielding legal results. And those legal results are determined by elements of an offense that identify facts. Facts are acts. Acts are conduct. And so this is one of the most fundamental issues of law that I've ever had the honor of speaking about before this or any other court. This concept that we should only subject individuals to criminal punishment or civil liability based on conduct that violates a provision of law in existence at the time the conduct occurred, so that they actually have responsibility for it. They actually have responsibility. You can't have responsibility for something that happens afterwards or for a law that imposes responsibility or legal culpability afterwards. You can only have responsibility for something that you know about beforehand and then make a choice to do or not do. So notice before conduct is the core of this, but any reference either in subsection G or in GHGA is simply a reference to the term used to identify what conduct, who it applies to, not when it applies. So the use of conduct, the word conduct, I'm sorry, strike that, conviction in subsection G is to identify who that subsection applies to based on the conduct that it is identifying. It is not a term to be used to identify what triggers prospectivity or when it applies. And it's the same if you took the statutory interpretation approach that the state is arguing and to apply it to Megan's Law, suddenly you look at subsection F. Well, subsection F, for its bar to termination, uses the word committed an offense within 15 years. So does that mean only a person who committed an offense but no one who got convicted of the offense would be barred? No, it's an absurd result. And in fact, what would that do to the HDJM case? That would turn that on its head. So there is no application of statutory construction, and there is no concept of due process or constitutional law that can alter the unswerving path to conduct as the one and only and necessary trigger to prospective applications of the law. And conduct, for conduct to have legal meaning, they notice must have preceded it. There is no conduct without notice, because that conduct would be value free. To apply a legal value to conduct, to say it's right or wrong, there must be a conscious understanding of what conduct is right and what conduct is wrong.
I think we have your position with respect to conduct. Are there other questions that members of the court have? Anything you'd like to add in bringing your argument to a close then?
Not at this time, Your Honor, but I do reserve 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Of course. Mr. Ingram.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice and honorable justices. May it please the court. The Office of the Public Defender agrees with JDF's position. And we add that if this court determines the legislature did mean for subsection G to apply to JDF, then the statute is applying retroactively. The state here is effectively asking the court to rule not that the legislature may apply laws retroactively, but that it may define what retroactivity is and is not by pointing to a judicial proceeding in the statute. This is the same argument that this court rejected in Riley v. New Jersey State Parole Board. In that case, the parole board argued that a 2007 law was not acting retroactively with respect to Riley's 1986 offense conduct, but prospectively to his 2009 Tier 3 designation. And that was what the statute said. But this court rejected that argument. You said that when assessing whether a statute is operating retroactively, we look to the predicate events that result in the disability that's later imposed. A retroactive law changes the legal consequences of acts completed before its effective date. And this is true whether we're in the civil or the criminal context. And this is exactly what is happening here to JDF. His conduct ceased prior to subsection G. If subsection G applies to him, it alters the consequences of his completed conduct, and it is therefore retroactive. There is a danger in the state's position, which is that it asks us to ignore the predicate events that result in whatever judicial proceeding is referenced in a statute. While the language in a statute may indicate the legislature's intent to apply a law to a certain group of people, possibly even retroactively with respect to one small group of people, pointing to a judicial proceeding doesn't avoid the question of whether that law has retroactive effect, thus avoiding the necessary analysis.
Mr. Ingram, can I stop you for 1 second?
Of course, Justice.
I want to make certain we're not confusing things. There is, number one, what did the legislature intend? Did it intend for a prospective or retroactive application, and what those terms mean? And then there's the concept of constitutional retroactivity. So when you're speaking about Riley, you're talking about constitutional retroactivity. So what I want you to tell us is, like, what are you referring to in your argument? what the legislature is doing or what you think the Constitution demands. But I want to make certain that those two concepts don't get confused. You following me?
I think I follow you, Justice Alvin. So here's the way I think about this. Let's look at ex post facto analysis, for example. You have a two-part question there, right? The first question is a law applying retroactively? And the second question is, does the law impose additional punishment? A law is retroactive when it applies to a completed crime or completed conduct, not to a conviction, not to a formal charge. And that's what's happening here.
But and, Mr. Ingram, I forgive me, but if the legislature did not intend the statute to apply retroactively, then we don't get to a constitutional analysis. First thing we try to do is figure out, like, what did the legislature intend? If they intended this to proceed prospectively, there's no need for us to talk about the Constitution, correct?
That's correct. And the Office of the Public Defender completely agrees with Mr. Maynard's analysis of prospectivity versus retroactivity, and that this court already ruled on the issue of retroactivity. What we're arguing here presumes that this court could possibly disagree with Mr. Maynard's analysis and suggest that the law may apply retroactively with respect to a small sliver of individuals like his client. Does that answer the question, Justice? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm muted. For the most part, what Mr. Maynard's argument is, as I understand it, was a statutory analysis. He wasn't, for the most part, he wasn't arguing that this is the type of punishment and therefore he was going to the basically ex post facto laws, as I understood his presentation. And you seem to be talking, when you're mentioning Riley, ex post facto application. It's a different argument.
I understand. I guess what I'm saying, Justice, is this notion of retroactivity doesn't change whether we're in the civil or the criminal context. The analysis that follows from there does change, but this notion of what a retroactive law remains consistent in our law, whether we are talking about a criminal statute or a civil statute. And this is exactly what is happening to JD.
I understand, but we don't use ex post facto for civil statutes, only criminal statutes. So, I mean, if we engage in that analysis, then we have to determine whether or not the statute is punitive. It's only if it's punitive would we apply the ex post facto clause.
Oh, that's right, Justice. We are not suggesting in this case that it's an ex post facto violation. We have not made that claim. We did put in our brief that the Office of the Public Defender has always maintained that this is an ex post facto violation, but nobody's argued it in this case. What we have argued is that the statute is applying retroactively if the court determines that it applies to JDF, and therefore the appropriate thing for the courts below to do was to engage in manifest injustice analysis. And the reason is because we have a civil law applying retroactively. So this issue was considered by the appellate division in GH when it found that subsection G constitutes a manifest injustice, primarily because it converts a rebuttable presumption of registration into an irrebuttable lifetime obligation. In that case, the appellate division said, subsection G eliminates an incentive integral to Megan's Law's remedial purpose by denying certain registrants any relief from the obligations inherent in lifetime registration. This respectfully is very different from what this court considered in Doe v. Poritz over 25 years ago. Every registrant at that time had an opportunity for relief from the registration obligation, but subsection G completely strips that opportunity away from them. And the Office of the Public Defender submits that subsection G's irrebuttable lifetime presumption retroactively apply in the sense that we mean it in this as part of this this case is manifestly unjust. Justices, I'm happy to take any questions at this time if you want.
Seeing none, Mr. Ingram, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Weinstein.
Good morning, Your Honors, Chief Justice. May it please the court. This is not a case about retroactivity. It's a case about the application of the plain language of statute as consistent with a non-punitive and remedial statutory scheme, which in different contexts, this court and other courts have allowed retrospective application to civil statutes. The state's argument boils down to 3 points. First, the statute is not being retroactively applied to the petitioner. The ineligibility of removal from registration applies to a person who has been convicted of more than one sex offense or a disqualifying sex offense. And if you look at the dates here, subsection G was effective on January 8th, 2002. The guilty verdict was in December 2002. The judgment of conviction was in March of 2003. No matter which way you look at it, he was convicted after the effective date, and hence it's not being retroactively applied to him. If you look at the plain language statutory analysis, which defense counsel is saying this court should look at, the legislature knows how to use the word conviction. They know what the word conviction means. That's what they used. By the very terms of subsection G, the offense date is irrelevant. So that's, the court need not go further. But if you look at the argument about, well, it's being applied retrospectively, retrospective application to pre-enactment conduct is not unusual when a statute has a remedial purpose. So to the extent that the offense date is relevant, the claim needs to be analyzed consistent with the remedial nature of Megan's law and the legislature's right to amend a statute to protect the public. And consistent with this purpose, our courts have regularly allowed application of civil statutes to events occurring before enactment when the statute is remedial. Both in Megan's law context and in other areas, I cited to a few examples in my brief. There's the one case involving the DNA statute where a juvenile had a deferred disposition, and then he violated probation. And then afterwards, DNA Testing Act was applied to him, and he said, no, you can't apply that to me. My offense conduct was beforehand. And the court said, no, this is a remedial purpose. And therefore, consistent with the remedial purpose of identifying offenders, it can be applied to acts occurring before the enactment. Another example is New Jersey Department of Protection versus Ventron, where in that case, it was applied to a polluter during the appeal of a case to pre-offense, to pre-statutory conduct. And that defendant was held to be liable. And they said, this court said, due to the remedial nature of the statute, it is not unfair. So this is not just in GH, it talks about this. The very language in the cases that petitioner relies on in Gibbons and in Phillips versus Curiel talks about if the legislature had a reason to apply it to acts before to pre-offense conduct. There are examples of that as I've cited. And then if we have to get beyond that, if we get to the manifest injustice question, subsection G has applied to petitioner here. There was no manifest injustice because he did not reasonably rely upon the possibility of relief from lifetime registration at the time of his conviction, because his subsection G was in effect 11 months beforehand. GH pled guilty and had an expectation at the time he pled guilty that he'd be eligible for relief from registration. And registrant here could not have had such a reasonable expectation. He was able to take into account the the fact that subsection G was in existence at the time that he made litigation choices. Those conclude my opening remarks, Your Honors, and at this time I open myself to questions unless I could continue more with the meat of my argument. But that's the outline of the state's position.
Please go on with your argument, Mr. Weinstein.
Very well. So a number of things that this court should look at. Very recently, this court in State versus Brown.
Can I ask you, you're done with your opening statement, Mr. Weinstein?
Yes, I am.
So I'm looking at the line. You agree we have to interpret what G means, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So you mentioned the beginning words. A person required to register under this section who has been convicted. And you're saying that the use of the term convicted there is an indication of when the legislature intended this statute to apply prospectively to? Is that your?
That's the first argument. If you look at the principles.
So I'm looking. So is there an alternate argument? And this is what Mr. Maynard said. When the legislature said a person required to register under who has been convicted, they're talking about the class of people to whom G applies. It only can apply to someone convicted. And I mean, so that is the language that the legislature used. Like, why isn't that a sound argument that the legislature had to find some way of defining the class of people to whom G applied? And it said the people convicted of these offenses. And therefore, that doesn't have anything to do with whether the legislature intended for this part of the statute to apply to conduct that occurred before its enactment. Are you following me?
I am following you.
Go ahead,
Your Honor. But you know, the legislature knows how to choose its language, and they use the term, you know, has been convicted of. And you know, and in interpreting that, you know, if there's a question of interpreting that, then you look to the entire statutory scheme. And as I've indicated, there's other examples where it's been applied retrospectively. In recently, this court in State versus Brown, when there was a question of a statute of limitation for failure to register, and the court said, well, as long as statute of limitations was passed after the offense, then it was not considered a retroactive application.
If your interpretation is correct, and we don't use the standard canon of interpretation that conduct is basically the point, then even just look at this case. The offenses were committed between May and August of 2001, correct?
Correct.
That was before the effective date of the statute. The criminal complaint was filed.
That was before, yes, Your Honor.
The criminal complaint was filed on October 4th, before the effective date, correct?
Correct. Although I would point out, Your Honor, that the indictment was on.
No. That's the point I want to say. If we're not relying on conduct, then these variables of when you decide to indict the defendant, when you decide to offer the plea, are all factors that are going to be dependent upon the prosecutor's charging process, the scheduling and the calendaring of the case by the court. And is that going to be fair? And also when the crime is reported, the act could have occurred a couple of years ago and then it's reported years later. All those variables would come into play if we're not using the time of conduct. Am I correct about that?
I understand your point, Your Honor. I would again just point out that if you look at the arguments that a petitioner is relying upon, that in terms of the this being a civil statute, it's not unusual to apply it to pre-offense conduct, as I indicated in State versus Ventron and State in the Interest of versus LR. Similar issues could have been raised, but it was allowed to be applied.
Mr. Weinstein,
yes,
I know this is a civil statute. It is entitled 2C, and this may be a little bit left field, but if we look at the savings clause that the legislature has placed in Title 2C, doesn't it also reflect that the legislature's thinking generally was that we look to the legal status of a person's conduct when we're examining how to deal with changes in statutes? It seems to me that it might not be a perfect fit, but it's another example of where the legislature's contemplating generally what was the original conduct that triggered the law that's being used to impact on the individual.
I would say, Your Honor, that given that that's in 2C, that savings clause would be more more designed to apply to a penal and ex post facto type analysis.
Well, granted, it is, you know, it is in 2C. This is in 2C, although it's remedial. You know, I'm just saying generally it gives some indicia of legislative intent about how the legislature is generally approaching changes in statute and generally thinking that that applies to the original conduct, except with certain exceptions.
Right. Yeah. I
would you agree with that?
I'm sorry?
Would you agree with that?
I mean, I agree that that's what the savings clause says. I mean, I don't agree that in this situation that there is anything wrong with applying subsection G to petitioner, you know, particularly if you compare this case to GH, and GH was in a substantially different position. Here,
are you asking us to change our holding in GH? I mean, GH says that, I thought pretty clearly that that the legislature did not mean for this statute to be applied retroactively.
But GH says to be applied retroactively pre-conviction. It uses the words conviction. And here it is not being applied to to pre-conviction events.
I understand your position.
Post-conviction.
Yes.
So that's the distinction the state would make between this case and GH. And then the second distinction, if you get beyond the pure statutory construction, is the manifest injustice analysis. And to say that petitioner would have changed his conduct, I just want to point out that at the time of the offense conduct, petitioner was subject to jail for committing sexual assault. At the time of the conduct, petitioner was subject to mandatory registration. Megan's Law was enacted in 1994. So it's kind of hard to fathom. The state would submit that it's not reasonable for petitioners to suggest, well, I knew I was going to go to jail. I knew I'd be subject to manifest to a lifetime registration. But you know, if I had known that I wouldn't have been eligible to someday be removed from lifetime registration, if I had known about subsection G, I would have altered my conduct. I don't think that's reasonable, and that is the basis of manifest injustice. It has to be
so at the time. F applied with that the 15 year opt out, correct?
At the time of the
part. So F, because we dealt with this in CK, but in the juvenile setting. So F says at the end of 15 years, you haven't been convicted of anything. You can go before a court, show that you're totally rehabilitated and that you do not pose a danger to the public. and you can get off, correct? That's F.
Yes.
So my question to you is, if at the end of 15 years, a defendant can make that showing, a court can make that finding, how is the remainder of this statute anything other than punitive? How can you call it remedial? After a person has been rehabilitated, after a person poses no danger to the public, how does the remaining part of that how is it still entitled to the characterization of a remedial statute, a remedial statute for either the public or the defendant, a public that's no longer in danger and a defendant who's no longer in need of rehabilitation?
Well, this court has repeatedly said that the registration requirements are remedial, and registration compared to, for instance, CSL and PSL, where this court has gone in a far different direction, is significant.
I'm asking you a precise question, though. Assume that there are these findings. A court makes a finding at the end of 15 years, you're totally rehabilitated, you don't pose a danger to the public. What remains of the remedial part of that statute? Tell me what part of that statute remains remedial.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that, you know, that in this context, that relief from registration has never been guaranteed, that a person has to make that showing, and that that it's remedial. The legislature can decide that a certain class of offenders, either repeat offenders or those who commit the most serious offenses, should not be ineligible, and it remains remedial and protective of the public, because there's a public reason for requiring these, public safety reason for requiring these people to register, and it's not punitive because it's not onerous just to register. There's no limits on where this person can live. There's no limit on where they can work, except for a narrow exception of a youth organization. It's completely unlike CSL, PSL with internet restrictions and the like. So the fact that somebody's no longer eligible for relief from registration does not make it punitive. With that
question, I'm sorry, Mr. Weinstein, go ahead.
I was just going to sum up, Your Honor, just to say that with that, this the statement lies in its submissions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Anderson.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The Attorney General relies on the brief it submitted in this matter, as well as the state's submissions in this case, and would like to emphasize the following 2 points. First, with respect to retroactivity, this case does not present a case of retroactive application of subsection G. Here, the registrant was convicted approximately 1 year after subsection G became effective. Much like the entire Megan's Law scheme, subsection G only applies to once someone has been convicted of a qualifying sex offense. We would not require somebody to register under Megan's Law unless and until they were convicted of a predicate sex offense. And similarly, we would not prohibit somebody from seeking termination from their Megan's Law obligations under subsection G without first requiring a conviction. So therefore, it is not the date of the offense that controls, but the date of the conviction. Given that the registrant in this case was convicted of a sex offense, of multiple sex offenses after subsection G was enacted, the 2002 amendment to Megan's Law was applied prospectively to him. And then I just want to briefly talk about the notion of fairness regarding applying subsection G to this registrant and others similarly situated. It is fair to apply this, to apply subsection G to these registrants. And I want to also emphasize that obviously at this point, most registrants who wind up on Megan's Law have committed their conduct post 2002. Therefore, we are talking about only those registrants who committed their conduct prior to subsection G being enacted and who are now subject to subsection G. But it is fair to apply this subsection to the to these registrants for the following reasons. The plain language of the statute makes it clear that the legislature intended the operative event with respect to this to be the conviction. Again, it is sound policy as well. We would never ask somebody to register in Megan's Law unless, in general, unless and until they were convicted. In fact, their registration obligations don't kick in until after they're completing their period of incarceration or at sentencing if they are sentenced to probation. Therefore, we would not seek to prohibit somebody from seeking termination of Megan's from Megan's Law until and unless they were convicted of either more than one sex offense or those two very serious sex offenses. The registrant also talks about it being unfair because his conduct was committed before he knew he was subject to subsection G. So I like the state, I have trouble with this argument because let's look at the legal landscape of this when he committed his conduct. He was criminal sexual contact was had been a crime since 1978. He was subject to possible jail time. In fact, I believe he did serve 60 days in a county jail. He knew that he was subject to potentially Megan's Law, and he also knew that even at the time before subsection G was enacted, that termination for Megan's Law was not guaranteed. So I have trouble with the argument that this is, that knowing all of that, this is the one thing that would have prevented him from committing the conduct that he was found guilty by a jury for. And in terms of any, what was discussed about notice, because subsection G was enacted about a year before he was convicted, he did have the notice that he needed to factor into any litigation strategy that he and his attorney wanted to partake. So in terms of whether, okay, now I committed the offense, now we know subsection G is enacted, I can, you know, maybe plead guilty to a lesser offense, go to trial, whatever litigation strategy or whatever decisions made, there was that notice there. So to briefly conclude, the prospective application of subsection G to JDF and other similarly situated registrants is fair based on the plain language of the statute, which clearly states the legislature's intent regarding the most serious sex offenders. The notice that these registrants had of subsection G prior to their conviction, and the state's interest in protecting the public. So the Attorney General asks that you affirm the appellate division decision in this matter. And I would be happy to entertain any questions that your honors have at this time.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Ms. Anderson?
Not at this time. Again, just to reiterate our main position that this is not a retroactive application. This is a prospective application to registrant G or to registrant JDF of subsection G, and that application of this subsection, regardless of what this court finds in terms of prospective or retroactive application, is fair and does not violate any notions of fundamental fairness that were discussed.
I have one question, Chief. On your second point about fundamental fairness, do I take it that your argument that fairness is met in the Attorney General's view because there was notice of the change due to adoption of subsection G that allowed him to adjust his litigation strategy, as opposed to any notice that could have resulted in him adjusting his underlying criminal behavior? Because that's what it sounds like I'm hearing to you, that notice operates only with respect to litigation strategy.
I don't mean to imply that notice operates only with respect to that, but with this non-criminal remedial statute, in the Megan's Law context, and again, we have to remember that while Megan's Law is contained in 2C, it is unlike any criminal conduct. So really, if you have notice at the time that you commit your conduct that you could be subject to jail, and that you are subject to Megan's Law, and that which he had notice of at the time of his conduct, and that you're being subject, your Megan's Law registration requirements, termination from those Megan's Law registration requirements is not guaranteed. This was at the time he committed the conduct.
It may not have been guaranteed, but it offered the hope of cessation.
You're correct in that subsection G was passed after the registrant completed his conduct, but I would also say that this is even before subsection G was passed. This was a showing that the registrant had to demonstrate in terms of I was offense free for 15 years. We know that the legislature used the phrase committed an offense rather than conviction. So we know that they know there's a distinction there. And they, you know, we can presume that they mean that distinction. And that also the registrant would have had to show that he did not pose a threat to the safety of others. And in terms of somebody who has been convicted of multiple offenses, sex offenses, who knows whether that would have been a successful showing. And what I will say is that in terms of the notice, then you compound it with the fact, as your Honor mentioned, that once subsection G was passed, he did have he did have notice in terms of any way that he might want to change his litigation strategy. When you take all of that together, that's what I mean when I talk about fundamental fairness.
There's a limit to the notion that he had control over litigative strategy, though, isn't there? The defendant at the time of the charges, for example, could have said, Judge, I want to plead guilty. But he could not have said, Judge, I want a trial date. I'm watching this bill. It may go into effect. I want a trial date beforehand. That was not within his control, correct?
Correct. But again, Chief Justice, I would also just draw your attention to, again, the fact that just based on the plain language of the statute, and I agree that if this is a case of statutory interpretation, the first thing to do is look at the plain language of the statute, right? So we know that here, to apply it to the registrant in this case, the legislature wrote, this subsection applies to somebody who has been convicted of an offense, and his conviction, therefore, it being the operative event, because again, it makes a lot of policy sense that we wouldn't either A, subject somebody to Megan's Law prior to, based on anything other than a conviction, and we wouldn't prohibit them from seeking termination from Megan's Law based on anything less than a conviction.
But counsel, it's one thing to say in the statute that this applies to the class of people convicted, and another thing for the legislature to specifically say, and I don't see it in the statute, that this applies before conviction. That's not in the statute, correct?
Correct. So with Megan's Law in general, with this subsection in particular, correct. I think the legislature
We'd have to interpret the statute to get to where you are. I want to ask another question of you. So when this was passed in Doe versus Porras, we said that F was remedial in part because it was a 15-year opt-out statute, right? At the end of 15 years, defendant can go before a judge and say, I'm totally rehabilitated, and no longer a danger to the public, correct?
When your honors, or when this court ruled on ruled in Doe versus Port, subsection G was not.
Okay, so now imagine that Mr. Maynard is proceeding under F, and he's actually able to convince a judge. His client's totally rehabilitated, and he doesn't pose any likelihood of danger to the public. Now look at G. I'm trying to understand, how is the remaining part of G remedial? Either remedial to the defendant or remedial to the state? If there were a judicial finding at the end of 15 years that he's rehabilitated and there's no public safety danger.
Because in terms of protecting the public safety, right, which is the state's goal and the purpose, the purpose behind the legislature enacting Megan's Law in general, subsection G only applies to the most serious sex offenders. It's those who have committed more than one sex offense and therefore are potentially more likely to offend again, more than one sex offense, or the two most serious two very serious sex offenses where it's aggravated sexual assault under a specific subsection and sexual assault under a specific subsection, I believe, against a minor. So this is the legislature clearly intended subsection G to apply to only the most serious sex offenders, convicted sex offenders, and therefore, your honors heard a case yesterday, I believe, that dealt with CSL, and to just emphasize, there are a lot of offenders who get terminated from CSL, PSL obligations, but not from Megan's Law. And that's because Megan's Law, the purpose of Megan's Law is registration and notification to the public for safety. So unlike CSL, the legislature has said, you know what? There's no restrictions on where Megan's Law does not restrict where these offenders live. Megan's Law does not restrict these offenders from where they work, maybe minus a youth serving organization. In terms of the internet restrictions.
Are there photographs posted on a website?
For some offenders, Your Honor, but the
you don't think that's going to affect their ability to get employment?
Your Honor, I would also, so the people who have who are posted on the public registry are the tier three. So it's not necessarily that somebody would be on the internet based on and they would be on the internet whether they were eligible for termination under subsection F or whether they were under whether they were not eligible for termination under subsection G. So the legislature clearly intended to require the most serious sex offenders to continue to register and made the determination that for the public safety, this is the remedial purpose of mandating continued registration for those offenders who subsection G applies to.
Other questions, anyone?
Thank you, Ms. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Maynard, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, to correct a couple of misstatements from the Attorney General, the public registry is not only for Tier 3, it's also for Tier 2. Tier 2 is, in fact, the largest number of individuals on Megan's Law. And subsection G is not the C1 subpart of subsection G is not for juveniles. It's for violent offenses. First, Megan's Law is, and another thing is our client JDF was in fact removed from CSL because he no longer posed a danger to others. Megan's Law is a remedial statute and program, but it still infringes on significant rights. And remedial statutes also still must have explicit or implicit retroactive language. And Megan's Law has such language only in subsection B, 1 and 2, not in subsection A, not in subsection G. So that you, Megan's Law is an entirely prospective scheme. That's the only way it was found to be constitutionally palatable by Doe v. Poritz and all of the rest. EB, you could list the whole thing all the way down to CK. So it's only constitutionally palatable as a remedial scheme that has tiered application and that has very limited retroactive application to only specific types of offenders, and that's only found in subsection B. We cannot conflate or bleed over the retroactive components of subsection B to all of the other subsections. The litigation choices of an individual have nothing to do with the prospective application of subsection G. Litigation choices are just that, litigation choices. They're not conduct, they're not acts, and even subsection G says that convicted of, thus the rest of, after the word conviction, of multiple sex offenses, that's conduct. So the only use of the word conviction is to identify what the person has done, the conduct. Megan's Law, the legislature's intent in subsection G was clearly and has been found by this court in CK and other cases, LE, to be confined to the preservation of funding under the Jacob Wetterling Act. It has nothing to do with remedial application. It has nothing to do with protecting the public. It was actually stated in the legislative statement that it was for the preservation of Jacob Wetterling funding, which is a prospective interest to continue going into the future funding. This court and the appellate division in GH determined and have concluded, and is now stare decisis and res judicata, that subsection G is not retroactive. So everything to do with retroactive discussion here should be stricken and from our minds and from this decision. It has nothing to do with retroactivity. There is no issues related to manifest injustice or vested interests or anything else that have to do with retroactivity law. This is strictly a case that is trying to define how we apply prospectivity in the enactment of a statute. The concept that has been stated several times, that JDF wouldn't have conformed his conduct in any way to the law had he known about subsection G, is frankly a little bit of a is a misstatement of legal conscience. We have, and it's been held in multiple cases, that all persons are presumed to know the law. The platitude that ignorance of the law is no defense, that almost every person in the world knows that platitude. And it's based on the very important legal concept that ignorance of the law is no, all persons are presumed to know the law. You couldn't
Mr. Maynard, excuse me for interrupting, but respectfully, this is rebuttal. So if you could cut to the chase and tell us what your focus is on the issues that had previously been raised, that would be helpful. We're beyond the 3 minutes already.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so it does relate to what's being said about the operative time when the knowledge of the law must exist. And that time must be before conduct, not at the time of litigation or conviction. So the final thing I'd like to say is this case spans the breadth and depth of civil and criminal law in identifying how the application of law may legitimately be imposed on individuals. And it must be based on conduct, and that to have that be a moral, ethical, and fair application of the law, they must have notice preceding the conduct of what the law sanctions and proscribes and what the law permits. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We'll